323-0367 consolidated with 323-0382 and 323-0442. Catherine Paterno as personal representative executor under the last will and testament of Philip Cardaz and as co-trustee and on behalf of the Philip Cardaz Living Trust appellant versus Betty K. Seamers Day Cardaz, Deborah Roper, Karen Mills, and Gary Hollander, Catherine Clancy, Adventist Midwest Health, and Joanne Donahue, Appalese.
All right. The clerk was kind enough to work with everybody about modifications to our time frames. What the clerk decided was fair will stand. And with that, Ms. Paterno, if you're ready, you may proceed.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Catherine Cardaz Paterno. I'm the daughter of Philip Cardaz, and I'm here to represent his interest, his trust interest, as well as my siblings, the Cardaz beneficiaries. The first issue was the 304B1 appeal of dismissal of counterclaims 1 and 2 are statutory claims under the Wrongful Death Act and under the Elder Abuse Statute. 740 ILCS 180, in particular, section 2.1, and 720 ILCS 5-17-56, and subsection G. I am under his last testament and will, dated October 1st of 2006, his personal representative, along with my stepmother, Betty K. Cardaz. I'm also his co-trustee under his 2006 trust that was amended and restated again in 2018. And as such, under the Wrongful Death Act, I have standing. Section 2.1 does not apply. My father's trust had assets and it was fully funded. The initial funding provision. And
why is that important, Ms. Paterno?
Well, because section 2.1 says that the wrongful death action brought is the only asset of the estate. I'm here to tell you that his trust was
the trust, though, not the estate. You're talking about the trust, right?
Well, his will was a pour over will. So anything that didn't make it into the trust, which was restated and amended in 2008, 11, 15, and 18, was fully funded upon his death. And a pour over will is basically a tool for the personal representatives that are named. At the time of his death, I didn't understand who my stepmother was. I've only learned that and gathered the documents and evidence that have evidence to me what occurred in this case. I was a witness to the June 29, 2020 meeting that was orchestrated by Betty Cardaz without authority and with Amita. I didn't know them as Adventists at the time. Amita St. Thomas Hospice. My father was on dialysis 3 times a week. He had just arrived home from dialysis. I was unaware that my stepmother had a meeting with Amita for an hour and a half, gathering different Amita professionals who at the time I didn't understand. And at that meeting, my father stated he was not going off
dialysis. Ms. Paterno, we're talking about your appeal here, though. You can't be testifying for us.
Oh, yes, Your Honor. But in the event that is being the only personal representative, being a personal representative, and Betty K. Cardaz having an obvious conflict of interest, that I have standing to bring the lawsuit under both the wrongful death action and the elder abuse statute. As far as Amita goes, this is not a medical malpractice action. That contract should have never been executed.
I'm going to interrupt you, if I may, yes. Ms. Paterno, and I'm going to go back to what I think was the import of Justice Heddle's question initially. Counts 1 and 2 were dismissed without prejudice. And under our case law, dismissal without prejudice does not finally determine a right. And if it doesn't finally determine a right, we do not have jurisdiction, as I understand it, under 304B1. So how do you get around that procedural bar as it relates to our jurisdiction?
Well, in this case, has a long history of 5.5 years and not even being at
But
discovery.
my question's a very specific question, and I would like you to address it.
I will, Your Honor, I apologize. As I was saying, that the fact that the judge stated that an estate had to be opened in order to proceed on the wrongful death claim, my position is that there needs no be, it's under 2.1 doesn't apply in this situation.
Let's assume the judge was wrong. I'm talking about our jurisdiction because he did not dismiss those counts with prejudice. So my question is, even if he's wrong, how do we have jurisdiction at this juncture, given the fact that the counts were not dismissed with prejudice?
Because it's determined, still determinative of the party's rights in order to proceed. It's attached to the fraud and the remaining counterclaims, which stood because it was subject to a motion to dismiss.
Would you agree that that position is inconsistent with the state of the law as it relates to what constitutes a final judgment?
My position is that under these set of circumstances that are very unique, the situation is that we should be allowed to proceed because it's attached to all the other counterclaims that are currently pending. And that we need a justice. It affects our ability to recover and what is recoverable with the remaining counterclaims that exist against Betty Cardoz at that time. So we believe that under 304B1 that it is determinative of the party's rights because it affects the ability to move forward. Should a finding be made on the other counterclaims that remained at that time, then we would still still have to go back to court in order to refile another action for the wrongful death claim because she could still claim parts of my father's estate, even though she had revoked the reciprocal trust. So our position as under 304B1, it still affects the administration of my father's trust and needs to be addressed by the court as a whole with the remaining counterclaims at that time.
Does the record support the suggestion that there are assets that did not pour over that exceed $100,000?
No, Your Honor.
All right, thank you.
In addition, because the account against Amita Adventist is not a malpractice action, it is in fact they knew for 6 months had pursued my father at the solicitation of my stepmother who had ulterior motives. And because we now know that the 2017 deed dated August 24th was forged by her, that she had financial motive. And so after pursuing Philip Cardoz from December 2019, where I was present and he rejected their services, through June 29th of 2020, for which I was present and he again rejected their services, Joanne Donahue, who's third-party defendant and an agent of Amita, allowed Betty K. Cardoz to sign a contract in secret after the meeting had dispersed. So our position is that based in fraud, there should have never been a contract to begin with. And the fact that you can't coexist on a life-sustaining measure and a life-ending measure, that should have never happened. And Joanne Donahue knew that Betty Kay had no authority. There was no healthcare power of attorney operative. My father was never declared at any point of his life, ever declared to be incompetent, incapacitated,
So, Ms.
but
Paterno, what sort of action was it then?
it was an action to aid and abet Betty Cardoz and able to under that wrongful death action, but for the fact that they allowed her to sign that contract, my father in December 2019, for the meeting I was present for, was given 9 more years to live on dialysis. And Betty Cardoz, because she had received an ERISA pension withdrawal liability letter, was pursuing to get my father off dialysis, which from 2017 to 2019, when we received that
So
message.
your allegation is that Nurse Donahoe aided and abetted Betty.
Betty K. Cardoz's actions in allowing her to sign that contract based in fraud, knowing that Betty Cardoz not only did not have the authority to sign, there was no power of attorney, excuse me, power of attorney operative, and there and therefore she had no authority to sign that contract. So our position is that the statutes governing malpractice and having a doctor required to sign off on it do not apply to the situation. Yes, Your Honor.
That was just a clock.
Okay. May I proceed? Or
Yes.
in addition, the actions against attorneys Gary Hollander, Karen Mills, and Catherine Clancy, the attorney litigation privilege does not apply. We're not talking about a relationship, an attorney-client relationship. We're talking about it. These three attorneys' affirmative actions during litigation, engaging in fraud in order to help Betty K. Cardoz secure the fraudulent transfer of Philip Cardoz's trust 50% interest in 723 67th Place. If you look at that deed, that's Exhibit U in the examiner's report, which is Exhibit W on page 40 of the third amended counterclaims and third party complaint, you can actually see Betty K. Cardoz's signature in Philip Cardoz's signature, which is why it was submitted for examination. And that deed transfers upon Philip's death, if he died first, his 50% interest to her and her descendants only. So that was the catalyst for her soliciting Amita's help in getting Philip off dialysis, but that these three attorneys during litigation engaged in fraud to help her secure that. The first being Gary Hollander had filed his motion to dismiss on April 13th, which contained an affidavit of Katie Clancy attached as Exhibit B that's dated April 5th of 2022, which indicated to me after discovering Katie Clancy's billing in October 5th, 2017 letter to Betty K. Cardoz only stating it was nice working with Betty and her sons. No Philip Cardoz on the billing, no Philip Cardoz in the letter. That Katie Clancy, when she signed that affidavit, then we knew that she was involved and she knew that Betty K. Cardoz didn't sign that or sign the deed on behalf of Philip Cardoz. In that Ms. Clancy's affidavit, she states that she went to 723 67th Place to notarize a deed, the deed dated August 24th, 2017. And what she omits is she prepared and notarized it and recorded it, but also she forgot that I lived next door to my father for 30 years at 733 67th Place. And if my father needed something notarized, or if he was asked to sign a deed, he would have certainly called me over. But the other part about it, in the motion to dismiss, Attorney Gary Hollander then takes Katie Clancy's statements and intentionally, materially misrepresents and changes the facts about it. It has my father and Betty Kay going to Katie Clancy's office to sign the deed on August 24, 2017. And he changed so many things about it that fraudulently, intentionally, materially misrepresented it in the motion to dismiss. And when I have proven that the August 24th, 2017 deed is in fact forged, Karen Mills submits to the court in writing that the next deed that she accuses me of forging is not a forgery because she needs it to be good in order to use the Illinois Tenancy Act in order to still lay claim to Philip Cardoz's trust 50% interest in 723 67th Place that had always gone to his descendants only since 1986. So that's why those three attorneys were then named as third-party defendants for their actions and fraud to help Betty K. Cardoz secure that tr our my father's trust 50% interest in 723 67th Place is why they came up. The statute of limitations argument then advanced by Ms. Clancy's attorney is based on relation back to the August 24, 2017 deed. But nobody knew that that deed was forged. Nobody knew until the accusations in this case came up, the discovery of Ms. Clancy's billing and letter in June of 2022 that in fact she was lying in her affidavit. And when we produce that, then you have two more. You have Karen Mills then lying about the December 15th, 2017 deed. So all these things culminated that the statute of limitations clock, there's no way we could have known, nor would I accuse an attorney of that without actual proof that their statements then, when she signs that affidavit to help Betty K. Cardoz keep Phillips Trust 50% interest, then we knew that she took an affirmative act in furtherance of that fraud and forgery, and is why she became a named party in this case. The last is Deborah Roper. Deborah Roper is my sister, who was bribed by Betty K. Cardoz. It's in the 911 tapes where these two individuals tried to have me falsely arrested 8 times. It's well documented, and it's actually attached to one of the filings as an exhibit, that on February 16th of 2022, Deborah Roper's attorney, my then new attorney, was going to file an amended counterclaims and third-party complaint that he omitted Deborah Roper from the complaint. Going back, the initial filing of 21MR310 was merged into 20MR923, which is the case that this DuPage case, on August 24th of 2021. My then attorney was given leave to decide how to proceed and handle the case, and he filed the first counterclaims and third-party complaint on September 21st, 2021. So the language that is in the transcript of February 16th of 2022 was written on page 7 by Deborah Roper's attorney. And it says that making the provision applicable with the one filing, that I could have one filing and I would be responsible for her filing fees. When I undertook my own representation, Deborah Roper was added back in with the second amended counterclaims on June 17th of 2022. Given leave to file an amended pleading, the third amended counterclaims and third party complaint, Deborah Roper's remained in it. There's never been a one filing. There's never been a commencement of a new action. The fact that she was dismissed was based on the judge being recently rotated into 20MR923 and not familiar with the case. So we went from a Judge Gibson to Judge Chapman back to Judge Gibson. In the interim, Judge Chapman didn't understand the entire history of the case when Deborah Roper was dismissed pursuant to 2619. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Ms. Paterno. Justice Heddle or Justice Bertani, any questions?
No, thank you.
All right, Ms. Paterno, you will have an opportunity in reply. And at this point, if my list is correct, we're going to move to Mr. Feldman.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is David Feldman, and I'm appearing on behalf of the appellee, Betty K. Cardoz, who is the plaintiff and was the wife of the decedent. Your Honors, it's undisputed that under counts 1 and 2, wrongful death and financial elder abuse, it has to be brought by the duly appointed executor or the independent administrator. That was never done. Judge Chapman, on the motion to dismiss, said that there was no standing under either statute. And you cannot self-appoint, which is what basically she was doing. And she being Ms. Paterno, keeps pointing out that the will names her as, and my client as the executor under the will, but you can't not file the action. You have to go to court and open up an estate for a wrongful death. I cite a couple of cases. it's clear that the way Illinois law has been interpreted, you have to open a wrongful death lawsuit in a probate in order to go through and file the separate, usually it's a law division case for damages for wrongful death. And the same case I cited also applies to financial abuse and elder abuse. The Your Honor raised the issue with respect to the 304B1 jurisdiction. In this case, you know, there was never a final order. Ms. Paterno asked Judge Chapman to have a 304A1 finding, and the judge denied it because there were underlying counts. I think it was a 6-count complaint against my client. The first two were obviously allowed under 619, but the other four, the judge allowed those to stay pending the case going forward. So he denied 304A1 and she brought it under 304B1. But we really don't have a final order, and that's supposed to be, as your honors are well aware, a case involving an estate, guardianship, or similar proceeding. In this case, it's not an estate because no one was ever open. She never tried. It's not a guardianship, and it's not a similar proceeding. The one case she cites, and it's Russell, has to do with the removal of a trustee battle. But this was not what is before the court. I mean, she's trying to bring a separate cause of action for the wrongful death. So I don't even think 304B1 applies. So I don't believe the court has jurisdiction. And I also don't believe that Justice Chapman did anything wrong in dismissing the case for not opening up a probate estate. That's it. Thank you.
Any questions for Mr. Feldman?
No.
No.
All right. It looks like we move next to Mr. Maruna.
Good morning, Justices, and may it please the court. James Maruna, M-A-R-U-N-A, on behalf of Appellee Third Party Defendant Deborah Roper. Today, we ask that this court affirm the Circuit Court's dismissal as to Ms. Roper. Now, the Circuit Court granted dismissal to Ms. Roper on two alternative bases. Confirmation of either will affirm that dismissal today. First, the Circuit Court dismissed under Section 13217 because the appellant executed two voluntary dismissals of her claims against Ms. Roper in this action. Second, alternatively, the Circuit Court dismissed under Section 2603 because it had warned appellant that she needed to clean up the complaint and plead short, concise, understandable claims, and she failed to do so. Now, in her notice of appeal and opening brief, the appellant only discussed one issue she wanted on appeal, that was the 13217 argument. However, as this court's review is under a de novo standard, it can affirm the dismissal under any basis stated in the record, 13217 argument, the 2603 argument, or even the 2615 failure to state a claim arguments that were in the motion to dismiss, but not ultimately a part of the court's dismissal decision. Again, hitting on any of those allows affirmation of that dismissal, and we believe all three are there. Turning to Section 13217, and this is the one that the appellant really focused on, it's well established in Illinois that a plaintiff gets one voluntary dismissal, and then after that, the dismissal, the second voluntary, it's made with prejudice. And that's what happened here. On March 29th, 2021, there was the initial action in the 310 matter. Plaintiff then dismissed that. On October 28th, 2021, appellant refiled against Roper. And then on 2/16/22, through her attorney at that time, dismissed that. And that was in the 20MR923 action. Okay. There's no debate. The appellate's brief talks a lot about that this dismissal was made by her prior attorney and not with her consent. That's a matter between them. It has nothing to do with the actual limited scope of what we're talking about today. And there's no debate that this was a clear dismissal. The attorney's dismissal was unequivocal. The attorney actually was the one who submitted the dismissal order for that. And there were email communications in the record the day before discussing that that attorney agreed he was going to voluntarily dismiss the action. The Circuit Court acted appropriately when this matter came back and saying, you've had your two strikes, we're done with this. And again, it was in the 310 action and the 923 action. Appellant's arguments on this point are unpersuasive. First, she talks about, again, the scope of the attorney, nothing to do with it. It was done there. As to the argument of acquiescence, couldn't be further from the truth. The record shows that every instance Ms. Roper was fighting this case coming back. There was never any acquiescence to it. And last, as to the argument that Section 1009 doesn't apply retroactively, that's just the procedural vehicle for voluntarily dismissing an action. An action's either getting dismissed voluntarily or involuntarily. And if you're taking a voluntary, it's 1009. Retroactive, nothing to do with it. It was clearly a voluntary in the record. So we believe that Section 13217 was a proper basis for dismissal, and it should be affirmed on that. However, if this court disagrees, let's turn to 2603. The circuit court alternatively dismissed the 2603 under 2603, rather, because Ms. Roper or Ms. Paterno failed to state a short, concise basis for the claim. My brief goes into it in detail, and I apologize, there's going to be math involved in this part, but essentially we're looking at a 46-page long complaint that inside each paragraph sub-references different sections. Now, we see it, for example, in one paragraph, there are 84 separate paragraphs reincorporated into it. And there's case law in Illinois, Rubino versus Circuit City, which is the First District 2001, that confirms you can't even do 12, let alone 84. The circuit judge gave a warning and said, clean it up. The appellant didn't do it. Upon no cleanup, dismissed. And last, under 2615, briefly, this court could also dismiss on that, affirm dismissal on that basis. Fraudulent misrepresentation doesn't work in the personal context. It only works in the business context. And so therefore, because there's no underlying tort, you can't have aiding, abetting, or civil conspiracy to commit a non-existent underlying tort. That's my time. Thank you very much. We ask that you affirm dismissal.
Any questions from Mr. Maruna?
None from me.
Well, thank you. And at this point, we'll move on to Ms. Weiler.
Morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, Catherine Weiler on behalf of third-party defendant appellees Karen Mills and Gary Hollander. Just to reset a tiny bit, because I realize there are a lot of moving parts in this appeal, Ms. Mills and Mr. Hollander represented various Ms. Cardez and members of her family in the litigation that's pending in the trial court. They are active attorneys in this litigation. And that's important for the court to be reminded of, because that's why the attorney litigation privilege applies, to preclude Ms. Paterno from bringing her claims against them. This case is exactly why the attorney litigation privilege exists. Without it, dissatisfied litigants would be able to try to continue their claims or seek alternative forms of recovery by suing the lawyers involved, not just the litigants. And in this particular case, even today, during today's hearing, Ms. Paterno has acknowledged her claims against Mr. Hollander and Ms. Mills are based on various statements or representations made in litigation. There is no other claim. That is what her allegations are premised on. That is why the trial court dismissed those claims. That is why this court should affirm. So specifically, we're talking about the third amended third-party complaint. And that's what brings those claims against Mr. Mills and Ms. Hollander. Count 8 is against Ms. Mills. Count 10 is against Mr. Hollander. Again, Ms. Paterno has conceded that the allegations she is making relate to statements or representations made by Mr. Mills and Ms. Hollander in the course of their representation in the underlying litigation, and that conduct is protected by the attorney litigation privilege. The privilege is a complete bar, regardless of the defendant's motive or the unreasonableness of the conduct. It's not limited to cases in which the allegations concern defamation. It's related to any matters or representations made in the underlying litigation that are pertinent to that claim. And certainly the allegations that have been made here involve representations pertinent to the underlying litigation. Any doubts as to pertinency would be resolved in favor of finding that the communication is pertinent to the litigation. But again, it seems very straightforward in this particular case. And that is exactly why the trial court made the ruling that it did. There is no reason for this court to reach a different result. It is a classic example of why the litigation privilege exists. If there are any questions from the court, I'm happy to address them. Otherwise, we ask that the court affirm.
Judge Bertani?
I do not.
All right, Ms. Weiler, thank you. And that leads us to Mr. Fetterman.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Jonathan Fetterman. I'm appearing on behalf of third-party defendant appellee Catherine Clancy. Clancy asked this court to affirm the trial court's ruling granting the motion to dismiss pursuant to a two-year statute of limitations. The two-year statute of limitations set forth in 13-214.3b applies to this dispute based on the undisputed facts. And I'll start with the undisputed facts because the claims against Paterno to Clancy are actually relatively straightforward. In 2017, Clancy prepared, notarized, and recorded two separate deeds, including the quitclaim deed that had issued. In that instrument, Clancy certified that she was familiar with Philip Cardez, Betty K. Cardez, that both were present before her, and both signed under their as a free act, free and voluntary act. After Philip passed away, there is litigation between Paterno and Kay, including a DuPage County action and a Kane County action. The Kane County action, which was filed as Kay filed an emergency motion for injunction and temporary restraining order against Paterno that was filed on October 19th, 2020. Paterno appeared via an attorney on October 29th, 2020. In Kay's motion, paragraph 2, she expressly states that Phillip's estate plan was in dispute, and she further attached the quitclaim deed as an exhibit to that motion. So no later than October 29th, 2020, Paterno had access to the quitclaim deed that contained the information I just discussed. In April 2022, Clancy signed there's an affidavit dated April 2022 signed by Clancy, which contained virtually the exact same information that was on the instrument in the quitclaim deed, which essentially was that Clancy knew Philip and Kay, that they both signed the instrument in front of them under their free will. The two-year statute of limitations, section 214.3b, applies pursuant to the plain language of the statute, as it applies to any action against an attorney arising out of an act or omission in the performance of professional services. Illinois case law is clear that there does not have to be an attorney-client relationship. It simply needs to be any claim in the arising out of the performance of professional services, which is exactly what happened here in the preparing, notarizing, and recording of the quitclaim deed. Ms. Paterno has, in an undeveloped argument in her briefs, has claimed that the discovery rule tolls application of the statute of limitation. But the relevant inquiry is when the plaintiff has, the relevant inquiry is not subjective when Ms. Paterno knew of her claim. It's objective. And the question is when the plaintiff has sufficient information to reasonably believe that they have suffered an injury and that it was wrongfully caused. And if the answer is more than 2 years before the date of the suit, the complaint is time barred. In Schrock versus Ungaretti and Harris LTD, 2019, LAP 1st, 181698, the court specifically took notice of numerous filings and other lawsuits that predated the lawsuit to find that there was enough information to know of the injury, even if the plaintiff did not know the specific identity of those involved in the wrongful conduct. The court noted that taking the information from those other suits was not taking judicial notice establishing facts of those cases, as Ms. Paterno appears to argue. Rather, taking that information demonstrated that the plaintiff had possession to give him a basis to know or reasonably know of his injury and that was wrongfully caused. And that is exactly what happened here. In October of 2020, Paterno had the quitclaim deed with the certification from Clancy, and it, under the objective standard, she reasonably should have known to investigate whether she had a claim against Clancy. Briefly, Ms. Paterno also makes a undeveloped argument as to fraudulent concealment, but fails to provide any citation, legal authority to support her claims, and fails to acknowledge that the affidavit contained the exact same information that was in the quitclaim deed. We also raised a secondary issue in our brief, which was the failure to comply with Illinois Supreme Court Rule 341. Ms. Paterno's alleged inexperience with appeals is not a basis for her to fail to comply with the rules. Unless the court has any questions. Oh, excuse me, there's one other point I wanted to make. Ms. Paterno mentioned that there was a finding that she has proven a forgery. There is no judicial finding of that related to the quitclaim deed. Unless there are any other questions, we ask the court to affirm the trial court's ruling.
Justice Heddle or Justice Bertani?
No question.
I don't.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Fetterman. And that brings us to Mr. Haynes.
Thank you. Saving the best for last. Good morning, Your Honors. Jeff Haynes for Appalese. Adventist Midwest Health, DBA, Adventist St. Thomas Hospice, and Nurse Joanne Donahue. We're here today on a lot of issues before the court, but I just want to focus on the issues against my clients here. This case originated, or let me strike that. Mr. Cardes passed away on July 5th, 2020. So that's now almost 5 years ago. This case originated on a lawsuit filed by Betty K. Cardes on October 21st, 2020. It was a verified motion for declaratory judgment and for other relief. And what she was seeking to do was have a restatement of trust declared invalid, to have third-party plaintiff Ms. Paterno removed as trustee, and she was also claiming breach of fiduciary duty related to various property, including possession of firearms, knives, art, antiques. Okay, so this really started as a trust case over property. That is what this litigation was filed as and involved and revolved around for several years until later, when in January 3rd, 2023. A third amended counterclaim and third-party complaint was filed for the first time against St. Thomas Hospice and Nurse Donahue. And at that time, third-party plaintiff filed the claim for wrongful death. And she's made that clear today. It's clear from the allegations in the complaint is a wrongful death claim. That is completely separate and apart from the underlying litigation. And we cited and Judge Chapman relied upon 735 ILCS 5/2-406B. And what that says is, and that's what allows a third party claim to be filed. And it says that a defendant may, by third party complaint, bring in as defendant a person, not a party to the action, who is or may be liable to him or her for all or part of the plaintiff's claims against her. We also cite in there People v. Brockman, which is a Supreme Court, that's 143 Illinois 2nd 351, as well as a Third District Appellate Court, Templeton v. Bladno Company, and that's 49 Illab 3rd 1057. And what those stand for the proposition is, and it's well established under Illinois law, that third-party actions cannot be used to maintain an entirely separate and independent claim against a third party, even if it involves the same general facts. And while I appreciate that third-party plaintiff has claims of fraud and contract allegations, and there's allegations of the term murder being thrown around, that is not derivative of the claims that started this lawsuit. And that's exactly what a third-party claim is. And in our motion to dismiss, we cite several other bases that I think this court can rely upon, if appropriate, as other bases to uphold dismissal of St. Thomas Hospice and Nurse Donahue. But at the very core, this is simply not a third party action. And I think it's significant that in none of the third party plaintiffs or appellants briefs does she ever cite that there's any type of derivative liability. The only argument made is that Judge Chapman mischaracterized this as a medical negligence case. And I don't even think that was so much as what he characterized it as just saying that this kind of fell within the purview of 622, which applies to healing art malpractice, but it can also apply to allegations of contract, tort, and otherwise. But really the basis of his decision is that this is simply a completely separate action and not a proper third-party action. So I would ask that Your Honors uphold dismissal of St. Thomas Hospice on Nurse Donahue, or in the alternative, look at the other bases such as failures of 622, and I think more importantly, failure to comply with the statute of limitations. So unless there's any questions, thank you very much for your time and the opportunity to argue.
Any questions for Mr. Haynes?
No, thank you. The definition.
No, thank you, sir.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Haynes. And that, Ms. Paterno, brings us back to you. You have 10 minutes in reply.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just briefly, as with respect to Betty K. Cardoz. The cases cited by Mr. Feldman all speak to cases that the estate has no other asset but the wrongful death claim. This is a very unique case with very unique circumstances, and I could find no case on point with this situation. There were almost a half dozen motions, petitions, declaratory actions filed in this case asking DuPage County courts to do something in this case regarding appointment of either affirming the beneficiary vote, remove Betty K. Cardoz, who's was determined to have forged several documents, not just the August 24th, 2017.
Mr. Turno, you keep saying determined to have forged.
Through the examiner's reports and independent evidence that was later discovered. That's what I'm referring to.
Did any court make that finding?
No, Your Honor. And I didn't mean to imply that there was a judicial finding. So, Your Honor, may I proceed?
Please.
Okay. In addition, there's nowhere in the statute that requires the appointment of the personal representative. And
in what statute?
In 740, the wrongful death statute, 180, has no requirement that a personal representative be court appointed or an estate opened in this situation, or that the personal representative need to be appointed in that statute. There's public policy reasons here that the conflict of interest and the opposing stepfamilies certainly should weigh into the consideration and give the family that's on the other receiving end of this the ability to proceed on bringing to light what happened in this case regarding the signing of a hospice contract that forced my father against his wishes off dialysis and into
hospice. Did you try to open up something in probate?
No, we did not. We filed the petitions in DuPage County in this case. So, and either they were not ruled upon or they were summarily dismissed along with the other counts and counterclaims that were filed. So we, in reading the case law that counsel had cited, there was, it all speaks to states that the only asset is the wrongful death claim being brought. There is no case on point where the personal representative brought the action. In addition, for Hollander, attorneys Hollander, Clancy, and Mills, we're not talking about something being said during litigation. We're talking about affirmative actions taken in order to secure the 50% interest in 723-67th place that was fraudulently transferred if Philip Cardoz died first. And in that sense, when he died first in these actions, Katie Clancy didn't need to reaffirm what she already stated in her verification in the August 24, 2017 deed. So there was no indication that the deed was in fact forged. But once she submitted that affidavit, attached to the motion to dismiss on April 13th of 2022, then we understood that she was trying to help refute the examiner's reports that had determined that Betty K. Cardoz had forged Philip Cardoz's signatures among several deeds, but the August 24th, 2017 deed in particular. So we didn't know if there would never make those sort of accusations. The deed could have stood on its own. The affidavit was done in order to refute the examiner's report. Gary Hollander's statements in that motion to dismiss he filed that took her statements, which make no sense when you understand that I live next door to my father.
Are you talking about Mr. Hollander's pleadings?
Yes.
What did he put in a pleading?
He put in a pleading. He took the statements that Katie Clancy made and changed everything about those facts in his motion in order to get to know that Katie Clancy's affidavit made no sense when you took into consideration the facts of Philip Cardoz, that I live next door, that I'm an attorney, that my both my husband and myself are notaries that could have easily walked over. Gary Hollander intentionally took those facts that were verified and sworn under the penalties of perjury and changed them to Philip Cardoz with Betty Cardoz went to Katie Clancy's office to execute the deed, which was totally misrepresenting the affidavit he had attached. And the facts were so extensive and so varied as to what was stated in the affidavit. There was no other result that you could reach other than that they were intentional. And then once that examiner's report and once the discovery of Ms. Clancy's affidavit and billing, which omit Philip Cardoz, so it's impossible that if he in fact met with her, it would have been included not only in the letter, but in the billing. And he's not nowhere included in any of it. So when that deed, the two preceding deeds are determined by an examiner to be forged, we have this other evidence that's independent that proves that Philip Cardoz never went to Katie Clancy's office, that as of her October 5th, 2017 letter, had not met with him. And then Karen Mills in an earlier pleading represents how she, how Philip's 50% interest by via the Illinois Trust Joint Tenancy Act also then belongs to Betty K. Cardoz. She submits to the court in writing.
Ms. Paterno, I'm going to interrupt you for a moment. Justice Heddle or Justice Bertani, do you have any additional questions on the attorney representation question?
No,
I do not.
Ms. Paterno, let me ask you, what is your theory for why your third-party complaints against Amitz and Ms. Donahue are in any way derivative of Betty's deck action? How are we getting there?
Well, we believe that Betty K. Cardoz couldn't have executed the contract that forced my father off dialysis without Amita and Joanne Donahue. That the derivative action that our counterclaims and third-party complaint were independent of that. So it comes from the counterclaims that were filed, but for Amita and
For you to file a third party, for you to get these people in as third party defendants, they must somehow be liable for what you're being alleged to have done vis-a-vis Betty. So unless you can show that somehow they're liable for that, they have no business being in your lawsuit. I guess that's the question I want you to answer.
Well, again, this is a very unique set of circumstances that, but for Amita, my father would still be living. So that it grows out of the fact that the Betty Cardoz was only able to cause the death.
Could you tell us what a third party defendant is?
The third party dependent is a party not named in the action. So the counterclaims are against Betty Cardoz, and third parties were brought in ancillary to the action as aiding and abetting and conspiracy. So that's why the aiding and abetting Betty Cardoz's actions in the wrongful death of my father is why Amita was brought in. Because without them, she couldn't have done it. So, and understanding that after years of litigation and the discovery of additional documents, including the fact that she was allowed to sign the contract because we didn't understand how she did it. So, but for Amita being present on June 29, 2020, my father would still be living today. That's why they're named. It wasn't a medical malpractice. It was in aiding and abetting in conjunction with the wrongful death action. May I proceed to clarify two other points? With Deborah Roper, that's a misstatement of the evidence. There was never a dismissal of 21 MR 310. It was consolidated and merged into 20 MR 923 on August 24, 2021. The court gave leave to my then attorney to determine how to proceed under the both cases and going forward, and that's when the first counterclaim and third party complaint was filed, with the same counts against Deborah Roper being stated. My
Ms. Paterno, your time is up. If you could conclude, please.
Yes, Your Honor. And I just would like the court to just consider the public policy arguments and the fact that the fraud of these attorneys is against the Illinois Professional Rules of Conduct, which carves out exceptions for reporting fraud. And in this case, the court should at least consider that, as well as the public policy arguments under the wrongful death action and the elder abuse action, which, by the way, was not addressed by Mr. Feldman. Thank you, Your Honors.
Any follow-up questions by my colleagues?
I just had one. Who's named as the representative of the estate in the pour-over will?
Myself and Betty K. Cardoz.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. The court thanks all the parties for spirited argument. We will take the matter under advisement and render a decision in due course.